So we start this morning with a panel discussion on the impact of austerity across various different sectors and the actions people have to take or have taken to undergo change. Our panel this morning, many of whom you will know, Nora Smith, Conor Shields, Owen Rooney and Paul McFlynn, who will each speak for about 5 or 6 minutes. Could I just point out that Professor Dave Vahinen has to offer her apologies. She was to be part of the original lineup, but unfortunately can't make it, and she has sent her sincere apologies. So at this stage, I think we'll just go straight into it. Our first speaker is Nora Smith. Can I just say a word of thanks on behalf of you and on behalf of myself to Nora for all her great organisation of this event. It's been fantastic, Nora, so well done on that. So, Nora Smith.
Good morning, everybody. Nice, light-hearted subject to start the day on, austerity. As Denzel says, my name is Nora Smith. I'm the Chief Executive of CO3. CO3 is a membership-based charity. We focus on supporting leaders that work within the third sector. And I want to begin by making some general observations in relation to austerity and leadership, in particular third sector leadership, leaving the economic analysis to our accomplished economists this morning. And not to sound too pessimistic, but I think it's a true picture of where we are. Ooh, was that me? I think that uncertainty, insecurity and vulnerability prevail within our sector, the third sector, and will continue to do so for a number of years. And I personally have become, as many CO3 members have, exasperated by our lack of political and public sector leadership in relation to the cuts and the austerity approach. I think there exists a deep sense of frustration with the lack of leadership that has prevailed and the knock-on effect of that, which is far-reaching. I think what has become increasingly obvious, especially so over the course of 2015, is this very uneven platform that we find ourselves standing on. Facing losses in funding, which for some members could potentially mean closure. For others, they're faced with the difficult task of downsizing and letting staff go. And at the same time, we're seeing an increase in demand for a wide range of services that the third sector has to offer. And third sector leaders are having to make really difficult decisions in relation to what takes priority. What services can they afford now to provide to a wide range of people? So thus, ironically, in some sense, we become one in some level one line of the delivery of austerity, but at a much more personalised and localised level. And there are very few of us that haven't been impacted by the cuts since the recession hit in 2008. And I think since then, I would say that we've become potentially, well, I think we have, our voices shrunk. We've got quieter. We're more cautious. And I think it's quieter because of the challenges in relation to the fact that we're locked out of the decision-making process. There isn't real engagement with our politicians, with the public sector in relation to where and how cuts are being made. And this has created a huge sense of disempowerment with little or no communication with our public sector leaders. And I think one of the consequences of this has been the lack of collective responsibility on the implications of those cuts, with little to no equality implications being considered about where and how cuts are being made. However, as well as becoming more our voices quietening, I think we've also become more cautious as well. Funding relationships have to be sustained. The government is a huge source of funding for the sector, for the third sector, and many organisations depend on that funding. So protest and lobbying remains mainly unvoiced in the public arena. Dissent is diminished and advocacy is limited within careful boundaries. And I think it raises a question for us all in relation to, has an agenda for survival and crept into to our sector? Are we compromised by the level of funding that we're dependent on from government? And I fundamentally believe, and I include myself in this as this well, that as a sector, as leaders, we could do better in relation to responding to the current challenges in relation to the cuts. I think the diminishing pot of funding, and I know I'm preaching to a room full of people that are very aware of the funding situation, as well as losing government money. There was reduction from Europe, there was reduction from big foundations such as AP, so those three taps are being turned off or turned down, and that increases competition within the sector as well. And with that then, increased competition, it fragments and weakens our position as well. So do we need to ask ourselves some fundamental questions about the values and roles of the sector in the current and immediate crisis? I stated at the start, we find ourselves in a very uneven platform, and that's a huge sense of disempowerment, and that's our common ground. However, I think we need much more than a common ground. We need a shared purpose, and I think we need to present a strong collective voice. Strong leadership is needed. Overall, I think it's a strange and difficult, and dare I say it, an really exciting time to work within the sector as well. I think one of our key strengths is our ability to be innovative and creative, and that was a point that was made by a few people yesterday. And I look around me today and I'm in awe of some of the leaders that are in this room who have spent their life fighting inequality, who are delivering incredible services for those in most need and to wider society. We're seeing more and more social entrepreneurs. We're looking beyond the normal channels of funding, but it's a work in progress and it's a transition, and that does take time as well. I think in the meantime, we need to be asking ourselves some difficult questions about how we're going to try and influence the austerity agenda. What is obvious to me, which I'm sure is obvious to all of you or most of you in the room, is that to date, the public sector reform, or as one political commentator a couple of weeks ago referred to as the public sector recession, has been mainly felt by the third sector. And then ultimately those on the ground who we support ultimately suffer. Thank you for your time.
Hard times that we had. And now, of course, we find ourselves in a very perilous and, in fact, parlous position. I myself am a product of public subvention, although my mother and father might say otherwise. But my education, my role, the people that I serve, the circumstance that I promote is all through public subvention, and we know in Northern Ireland that 70% of our activity is supported from the public purse. So we know the level of dependency that we have in the face of this so-called austerity. But I think that austerity isn't a weather condition. Austerity isn't meteorological, it is ideological. And therefore it is a set of ideas that can be challenged. And the way to challenge ideas is to come up with better ideas. And the way to come up with good ideas, better ideas, is to be creative. And the way to be creative is to support your local artist, get involved, draw inspiration, be facilitated, and start to try and envisage something better. My job is to make things better every day. That's a personal conviction, but it's also part of what I do. And the arts struggle to do that. Many of you here today work in the arts, but you also have been touched by what the arts mean. Artists are resilient people. Our communities have had to be resilient over the years, but the most marginalised in Northern Ireland have both lost the most and indeed, somewhat paradoxically, have the most to lose. And any shift downward in terms of subvention for their need becomes very critical to their future, indeed to our future. At the minute, my headspace is trying to think beyond this so-called period of austerity. As I said, I'm part of the drafting group for the Ministerial Arts Advisory Forum, and what I'm trying to get across, hopefully, positively and persuasively to the executive, is that we have to look beyond. We have to see ourselves in perhaps 2026 and what Northern Ireland, what we want for this place. And at that point, what will success look like? So we have to challenge in a way that says that we have to support infrastructure currently so that we have a Northern Ireland that is still fit for purpose at some other point. And we have to then be a digitally literate, creative, engaged, civic place where we can actually hear people and we can see people. The arts have a phenomenal way of offering that visibility and that platform, but we run the risk at the minute of undermining the arts so severely that potentially the arts will shrink and diminish, and that will diminish all our lives. The power of agency, the power to transform, the alchemy of thought, creativity and ideas is crucial to our futures and to the futures of our next generations. The situation, I don't need to spell it out for you. The arts in Northern Ireland have a revenue grant of £10.2 million. There's lottery money of £10.4 million. We are looking at an in-year cut this year in excess of 6%. It could be more like 10%, but this could be the start of another guessing game. What we have to do is collectively start to address why we counter these cuts. And this is what we're trying to do through Arts Matters NI. And I would urge you, if you've ever supported a local artist, pardon me, if you've ever taken part in the arts, if you feel that the arts are in any way matter to your life, and of course they do, our lives are completely touched by the arts, try and support this campaign. We have a whole toolkit for helping address politicians, address local councils, address those people in influence. I've been going to every party political conference trying to tell our politicians why the arts count. We only have £10 million. That is less than a second of the health service, so it is less than a second of our education service in terms of pro-rata timing. We cannot afford to lose more ground for the arts but we have every ability and every possibility within the arts to support our communities and ourselves into the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Connor. Our third speaker is
Owen. It's now 8 years since the global economic crisis emerged. In terms of the theme of changing the conversation, it was a remarkable time, because with the conventional wisdom so obviously failing to deliver, it was socially acceptable to talk and to think outside of economic orthodoxy. Mainstream papers like the Financial Times were talking about the relevance of previously maligned economists like Keynes and Marx, and predicting an end to the form of capitalism initiated by Margaret Thatcher and embraced with a few social democratic add-ons by New Labour. The crisis represented a rare opportunity to fundamentally change the way that the economy is understood, discussed and managed. But the consensus established by Thatcher was so successful, so complete, that there was no real opposition ready to seize the initiative and take politics in a new, more progressive direction. The window of opportunity soon closed, and it fell to the people with the very mindset that created the crisis to define its causes and prescribe its solutions. The new analysis was set out in David Cameron's 2009 speech, in which he declared that the age of irresponsibility is giving way to the age of austerity. Cameron was referring not to the gambling and greed of the financial institutions which caused the crisis, but to the public sector, which took on a huge amount of debt, bailing out and recapitalising those very institutions. So the financial sector was written out of the script, and the problem was redefined as one of extravagant public spending, logically to be addressed through a reduction in public expenditure, austerity. The Labour Party, keen to disassociate itself from New Labour, declined to challenge the austerity story, allowing it to circulate freely among opinion formers, acquire authority through repetition, and develop into the potent discourse it is today. The great thing about austerity is that it is capable of being marshalled for various purposes, not just to support spending cuts. Declaring with a heavy sigh that we are in an era of austerity helps to lower expectations towards a dysfunctional economy that is generating chronically low levels of economic growth and that is geared towards the interests of the most wealthy. Indeed, as evident in welfare reform, it is those who benefit least from the economy who are also expected to bear the burden of austerity. I think Connor is right to say so-called austerity, not just because the word is the word of austerity is such an ideologically loaded one, but also because it's an inappropriate way to describe one of the richest societies the world has ever seen. The problem here is not that, as we are so often told, that there isn't enough money, but that the money is concentrated in the hands of so few. For that reason, the beginnings of a public conversation on the issue of economic inequality is a very interesting development. It has long been argued that inequality is socially destructive, but evidence is now emerging that it is also economically damaging. There is considerable potential to build a politics of change around the concept of economic inequality, and that is, in my view, is where we need to move the conversation. And if we want to address inequality, and if we want to increase public spending, then we'll have to take more control of our tax affairs. In Northern Ireland, there's been strong opposition to welfare reform and to budget cuts more generally. But with limited control over taxation, it is difficult to adopt a different approach. Fiscal devolution is high on the UK political agenda at the moment, but here there's been a very narrow focus on corporation tax. It's time to widen out the discussion to other taxes, such as income tax. So in conclusion, the issues of economic inequality and fiscal devolution, I feel, offer a promising basis for an alternative way of naming, talking about and addressing the economic problems that are currently framed by the disingenuous and dangerous discourse of austerity. And one more thing, let us make sure that when the next crisis comes, and it might not be too far away, its interpretation is not again left to the very people who cause it. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. My name is Paul McFlynn. I'm from the Nevin Economic Research Institute. We are an economic think tank based in Belfast and Dublin and supported by the trade unions, nearly all of them, anyway. I was struck there when Connor said about wanting to strike a note of optimism about the austerity debate, and I've been accused in the past of not really being able to manage optimism in any way, shape or form, and I was sort of epitomised at a slideshow for a previous presentation which ended with the phrase things are terrible and they're only going to get worse. So I tried to sound slightly more optimistic, but looking through my speaking notes here, there's not much chance. Owen mentioned the theme of changing the conversation on austerity, and I think as evidence in the UK general election, we do have a problem in terms of talking about austerity. It's very, very easy for anyone who's arguing against, whether it's budget cuts or welfare reform, to get tagged as somebody who's weak, and that the tough decisions and the right decisions about getting the national finances in order and the most awful of them all, living within your means, whatever that means, and comparing whole economies to a household and the idea of a prudent housewife, the metaphor is so riddled with errors, it's laughable. But what are we actually talking about when we're talking about austerity? And things immediately move, as Owen said, to the public sector, to debts and deficits. And I always find it amusing, it's still after, 7 years of having this conversation, regularly on news programmes, people confuse the terms debt and deficit. I mean, this is the building blocks of austerity, and the most ardent proponents of austerity still don't know what they're talking about. Deficit obviously being the gap between the amount of money the government takes in taxes and the amount of money it spends. The national debt being the pile-up of all those deficits over many years and all the money we had to shove into the banks back in 2008. And this was even funnier down in the... I say funny, it's not funny at all. Down in the Republic of Ireland, I think it was back 2012, there was a referendum on the EU fiscal compact, which was a referendum that agreed that... And Ireland has to have a referendum on every EU discussion, irrespective of how important it is. But basically that every EU government would commit to reducing its deficit and reducing its national debt. But it went further than that and talked about something economists like to call the structural deficit. Basically, the gap between your government revenue and your government spending, but adjusted for the fact that you might be in a recession at the time. It's the bit of the deficit that won't go away even when you go back to normal times. And this is now enshrined in the Irish Constitution as a prerogative for government to see through. Nobody knows what the structural deficit is. Gather together 5 economists, ask them what the structural deficit is, and you get 12 answers. They cannot calculate a structural deficit until about 3 years after it's happened. But this is what we've decided to base our economic policy on. But even looking at debts and deficit, we don't talk about them as actual numbers. And quite rightly so, but they're presented in the media as percentage of GDP, as percentage of national income. And then this gets you into the conversation about what is GDP and what is national income, because a year ago they decided that they weren't calculating GDP correctly and they wanted to amend a few things. But one of the big things was they wanted to recognise the amount of economic activity that is illegal economic activity, the drugs trade, prostitution, the sort of sex, drugs and rock and roll of statistics, you know, all brought in. And then in the Republic, it increased increased the level of GDP in the Republic of Ireland overnight. Now, nothing on the ground, no fundamentals changed, but Ireland's national debt decreased because it's measured as a proportion of GDP. I know we have a speaker from Greece later on, and Greek debt, national debt, exploded after it was given assistance from the Troika. Now, part of that was, yes, actual national debt increased, but it is calculated as a portion of GDP, and inflicting the especially cruel form of austerity which was inflicted on Greece decimated their economy, reducing GDP. And, you know, it's basic maths, you know, one goes over the other. If the bottom half gets smaller and smaller, your national debt is going to look bigger and bigger. And the debate about debt, I think, is particularly the most pernicious kind, because George Osborne's been talking about now, and he's a great man for a terrible metaphor, and he's talking about, you know, fixing the roof while the sun shines, and saying that governments are now going to have to, by law, run surpluses every year in the good times. Ireland and Spain had among the lowest national debts in the European Union before the crisis hit. Having a low national debt wasn't going to prevent us from what was coming down the tracks to us in the recession. It was the collapse in the private sector and the subsequent collapse in tax revenues that brought us to the situation we were in. Yet suddenly, quite abruptly, in about 2009, 2010, we were focused in on public spending as the greatest evil of all. And as I was saying earlier about GDP, we have to start asking ourselves, what is it that goes into making our economy? What's in the private sector? What has made it so inherently unstable? You look down in the Republic, and to a large extent here, a focus on property and construction, which just sort of went to such great heights it left reality. And over in the rest of the UK, the complete over-reliance on a bloated and irresponsible financial sector. And ask yourselves, what has really changed? You only have to look back over at the, you know, scandals in HSBC and big banks in the City of London, and then look at house prices to hen in the Republic of Ireland. We're back to the races. And, you know, they claim, you know, in the Republic of Ireland, you know, the public finances have been fixed. If a mild recession, hits the Republic in the next 5 to 10 years, it will be as exposed, possibly if not more exposed, than it was back in 2008. And that's the point we need to ask. You know, if we talk about the idea of change in the conversation, we should stop talking about austerity, because we are sort of boxed into a conversation we are never going to win. The game is rigged. We need to start talking about the type of economy that we create, the type of economy that is stable, that is sustainable. You talk about, particularly in the housing sector, and you look at what's happening with property prices, particularly down in Dublin, but also in London and other areas. How did we get so far removed from the idea that you build a house to make a home for somebody? How has it become something that's become so unstable that it can bring down whole economies? And just to say, you know, to bring it back here to Northern Ireland, bring it back to the debate, sort of maybe on austerity, just to finish on this point, and, you know, the whole idea of welfare reform. I mean, I know our politicians probably do get have gotten a good bit of a bashing here. I sometimes feel quite sorry for them, because they are being dealt a massive slice of austerity from Westminster, and maybe their greatest crime is, you know, lacking the imagination to try and make something better of it. But we are kind of boxed in here. But it's one interesting point about welfare spending here and welfare spending in the rest of the UK. Welfare spending in the UK did increase massively over the last number of years, but it's not for the reasons that you think. The state pension and pension-related benefits are now accounting to creeping up between 45 to 50% of overall welfare spending. That isn't being touched in the welfare reform debate, but it is a large and massively increasing section of spending, mostly because there's a lot of people getting older. The other two massive ones are housing benefit. And because housing benefit, particularly across the water, because they sold off all their social housing through the Help to Buy scheme back in the 1980s, they never replaced the social housing they had. They still had the same social housing need. And with rents skyrocketing across the UK, government was giving out millions, billions to private landlords, having to pay whatever the going rent was. And the third one is tax credits. And this is important because it's now being put on the table. We talked about the 12 billion of welfare cuts they were planning. The Conservatives said that they were going to plan after the election. They wouldn't tell anybody what it was. It's now becoming disgustingly clear. They want to take 5 billion of that out of tax credits. Tax credits were, and opinion is divided, obviously put in there to give something back to people on low incomes, to reward people for being in work. At the same time, they have allowed a massive glut of low-paid jobs to build up, and in effect have the government subsidising, and it's usually very, very large employers, paying very, very low wages. And the debate is now centering on withdrawing huge amounts of, tightening the eligibility criteria for those tax credits. That, I think, may be, well, that may be the step too far in terms of the UK debate, because the Conservatives have managed to build up this image of themselves as, you know, blue collar and helping hard working families. If we cannot break that monopoly they have on the basis of this policy, then we're all doomed. Sorry, that isn't really an optimistic note to finish on, but it's good as it got. Thank you.